This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lee Daniels, directed the new film Precious. Set in Harlem in 1987, it's about a 350-pound, illiterate, 16-year-old African-American girl who is physically abused by her mother and pregnant by her father for the second time. Sounds pretty grim, but Daniels finds the strength in this girl, and he gets terrific dramatic performances from Mariah Carey, the comic Monique, and newcomer Gabourey Sidibe, who plays Precious. Daniels produced the movies Monsters Ball, The Woodsman, and Tennessee. He's a producer of Precious in addition to being its director. The movie is based on the novel Push by Sapphire. Precious won 3 awards at the Sundance Film Festival, including the Grand Jury Prize and the Audience Award for the Dramatic category, and it won the People's Choice Award at the Toronto Film Festival. Lynn Hirschberg in the New York Times described the film as combining street-smart bravado with an art house sensibility. Let's start with a scene. Precious is talking with her welfare caseworker, played by Mariah Carey. Here's Carey and Gabourey Sidibe.
You don't even like me.
Have we not been in this room together for like a year, discussing your life?
Does that mean we like each other because we discuss my life?
I can't speak for you. I can only speak for me. And I do like you. I do.
So are you Italian? Or what color are you anyway? Are you some type of black or Spanish?
What color do you think I am? No, I'd like to know, what color do you think I am?
My throat is dry.
Your throat is dry?
It's really hot in here.
It is kind of hot in here. I'm gonna go get a soda.
Lee Daniels, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me agree with everybody who says that Gabourey Sidibe, who plays Precious, really does an extraordinary job. And she wasn't a professional actress. How did you put out the call? I mean, did you have a casting call for 350-pound teenagers? I mean, how did you find her?
I called an agent in Hollywood and said, listen, can you help me? I'm looking for a 355-pound black girl. And there was silence on the phone. And I realized at that point, okay, well, here we go. I got to attack this from a completely different way of that I ordinarily attack the casting process. So that meant, and that meant work, a lot of work. But my brilliant casting director, Billy Hopkins, and my sister in Los Angeles, Leah Daniels Butler, began a search for the girl. And they saw, if I saw 400 girls, over 400, they had to have seen at least 1,000 girls. And we actually narrowed it down to like 20 girls. And these girls were in a Precious camp where they were dancing. And that was really a great time. It was a different type of way of casting. I wish we had done footage on it or even a reality show, because each week a girl would be dropped off. And these girls were...
It was like a Precious training camp you were talking about.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, they were dancing. They were having acting lessons. Karen Giordano, brilliant acting coach, came in and was teaching them acting. I had a dance instructor. I had a vocal instructor. And it was so beautiful watching these girls who I'd find at McDonald's, or we flew in from, a Radio Shack in Chicago.
Wait. Let's stop right there. So you'd go up to somebody at McDonald's and say, well, they look heavy. they look fat and maybe talented. I will go up to them. I mean, yeah.
They immediately, it was not as easy as you would think, you know. They were very guarded. They didn't know what to make. They, I thought nothing of it. But in hindsight, there was resistance and there was a massage and there was a, it wasn't easy coasting these girls into the two times that I did it. Once was at a theater, the girl serving behind the counter, you know, at the movie theater, and the other one was at a McDonald's. And it was not, it was not easy. But so anyway, they did this, and then they put out open calls, which is really a good thing too. They had put posters out in schools and stuff and around the country. And so anyway, we had these 20 girls narrowed down, and they were the real girls. These girls really were, they had problems speaking and their diction. And Gabby came in to Billy's office, Billy found her, And she auditioned. It was a great audition. And then when I meant to meet her, she started talking like this white girl from the Valley. And I just thought, my God, this is, who are you? And I realized at that moment, if I had used one of the girls that was really precious, that I would have been exploiting them. And it would not have been, I would have made a mockery of Precious. So this girl is not Precious. And so she's, you know, she has a different life. And she's, though she's from Harlem, she's very worldly. And really have a sense of self-confidence that either, I don't know, I've never seen anything like it before. In my life, she is truly, you know, either in denial about her physicality or she's on a higher plane. I know she's got several boyfriends. She's so secure with who she is that it's mind-blowing.
And as you say, it's a real performance. I mean, I've seen her interviewed, and she speaks really well, but in the movie she has to be somebody who's very self-conscious, very self-protective, and really mumbles, can hardly read. It's really a fine performance. You also got a terrific performance out of Monique, who's best known as a comic and talk show host. She mm-hmm. plays the mother, the very emotionally and physically abusive mother. And before we talk about her performance, let me play a short scene. And this is a scene, Precious and the social worker are in the office. Precious has explained to the social worker, the Mariah Carey character, about the abuse that she suffered at the hands of her father and her mother. And the social worker has called in the mother because the mother insists that she wants Precious and Precious's new baby to move back in. And, of course, Precious doesn't want to do that. So here's the scene where the social worker, played by Mariah Carey, and the mother, Mary, played by Monique, are talking with each other.
You've been calling this office saying you want to be reunited with Precious and your grandchild. Now I really need to know what's gone on in that home.
Miss West, I understand we need to discuss it, but I'm just telling you, you said I've been calling here and I've been wanting to see Precious and my grandson. You goddamn right I want to see him because they belong to me, okay? Now, there was a time Precious had everything and I done told her that. And me and Carl, we love Precious. And you need to know that. We love Precious and we had dreams. Precious was born around the same time Miss West's son got killed. The summertime. She was born the summertime. Remember that?
I was born in November.
November. Yeah. That's right.
How did you know that Monique could pull that off?
We're very good friends. And I had already worked with her before on Shadow Boxer. And through that friendship, you know, Precious came along. And though in the book, Precious's mom, Mary, is actually bigger than Precious. And it's sort of the reverse in the film. I knew that Monique would tear it out. So it was just something intuitive, you know. My intuition has led me to where I'm at. I've rarely been wrong about an actor.
Now, Mariah Carey, you cast as a social worker. You'd also work with her on Tennessee, which you produced, and she's really good in this role, she's very convincing. How did you prepare her for it?
I she's a very good friend, and it starts with the walk, it starts with the hand movements, the actors, you know, the development of a character starts all in the walk, and with Mariah. You know, Mariah's had stiletto pumps on since she's been an embryo. And she walks on her tippy toes, even out of her pumps. That's how trained her feet are to walk in stilettos. So for her homework assignment, she had to learn to walk on the palms of her and the heels of her feet. So that was very hard for her. And then I had her open them up so that she was sort of walking like a duck. And that started a character. We sort of, you know, went on from there. We went by deepening the voice. And I studied every, because I'm friends with her, so I know every Mariah thing that she does. And so everything that she does, we had to undo for this character.
Now, among the producers of your film, you have Tyler Perry and Oprah. And mm-hmm. they've both said that they've been abused. Monique, who's one of the stars of your film, says she was abused. And you've talked in an article about how you were beaten by your father. There just seems to be like a whole culture of abuse.
Well, I don't think that, come on, do you really think that Tyler Perry and Oprah Winfrey and Monique were abused? Come on. No, I'm just
Excuse me.
No. I have to laugh about it because, you know, it's such a tragic
What's the thing? It's so tragic and
it's
so horrifying.
It really is. And look at the people that they've become.
Remarkably, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, look at every one of those people that you just mentioned. They can actually laugh about it and chuckle inside.
But you must ask yourself, like, why is this?
But I think that you have no, well, if you cry about it, where is that going to get you? You know, I think that that's what makes them icons in their own.
No, but I mean, why does it happen in the first place? Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's hereditary, you know? The physical, I have not been sexually abused, so I don't know about that. But I think that, okay, let me ponder this for a moment. I think that maybe, this is in Black culture, I think, okay? I don't know about white culture. But I think that in Black culture, it stems from slavery. I think that, you know, they were beaten. They knew nothing but to beat. I think that my father was probably, I know, beaten worse than me. And I know that his grandfather was tied to a tree and horsewhipped. And so on, and so on, and so on. I think that that is what, and you know, the genius of Precious is that she will not, the cycle's broken. When she walks out of there with her kids, you know, for the way she says to her mother, I never want to see you again. Now, if that were me, I'd jump over and strangle her after everything that she done. But you know that the cycle is broken. Look, I was abused physically. It's a struggle when I look at my kids screaming at me at 13, I have twins. It takes everything I have not to jump across the room and strangle him, you know? And it's because that's what's been brought up in me. That's what I know to do. But, you know, I know that the cycle has to stop, and that's the beauty of Precious.
So with your father, who you said beat you, he didn't sexually abuse you, just to make sure that's clear.
No.
But he did beat
Never.
You. So was it possible to, like, really love him at the same time?
No, not at all. Not at all. And it wasn't until late in life that I, you know, I also feel bad about talking about him like this because he's no longer here.
Like he can't defend himself?
Yeah. And, you know, I have another uncle. I can't even talk about it. That's too personal. Here's the thing. I feel bad about talking about him because I've grown so much to love him, you know, and understand him as I become a man, and that it's hard to break the cycle, you know, and I think that when you see your kid walking down the stairs in his wife's high-heeled patent leather red pumps while you're having a card game down with the guys that you are in the, you know, you're a cop with your fellow cops. What do you do? What do you do when that's what, you know, you've been taught?
That was you walking down the stairs on the pumps?
Yeah. I didn't know. What do I know? I'm 7 years old, putting on my mother's pumps. I think they're sort of sexy. I'm walking down, you know, walking down with my hands on my hips and my dad's playing cards with his cop friends, and here I come. And then it continued, and I think that I know that he loved me. You know, I wanted to think that he loved me, but I know that he loved me, you know? And I think that he did the best he could. I remember someone calling him the N-word in front of me, one of his bosses or something. And we got in the car, and I said, why did you let him do that to you? And I was 11, It was right before he died. And he slapped me. That was the last time he slapped me. Hard. And, yeah. And I think that, you know, it took his frustration
out. Why did he slap you for that, do you think?
I think because I was talking back to him, that was his way of dealing with the frustration and the pain that he felt and the embarrassment that he felt and the castration that he felt. I think that's what it is. And I love him for it. I love him for it, you know. I love him so much for the wonderful things that he did to me, you know, the wonderful things. You know, he really forced literature and reading on me. And he was a great poet and stuff. And I never talk about that. People just want to hear about the abuse, you know.
How did he force the literature on you?
He loved reading. He was just, gosh, he was a brilliant writer. And anything artistic that I got from him.
What kind of writing did he do, and how did you get to read it?
He wrote poetry. I think he knew he was going to die, and he wrote a poem about his death, his preeminent death, which is really spooky. And then he just would write stories, short stories. And they were fascinating, you know, and I found them. Read one recently. It holds its own through time. And I, you know, I don't know. And here's the tricky part. The tricky part is that what I did learn was that what he did to me was worse than anyone could ever do to me. So nothing that's been thrown at me, I can't deal with. Does that justify abuse? I don't know. But what it does do, it made me a strong man because I can deal with anything now, anything.
Now, your father was a cop, and, you know, it's interesting. He probably could have arrested people, or maybe did arrest people for beating their children, and yet...
He didn't at that time. I don't think at that time it was a different party, you know? It was a different world. I don't think that the laws were enforced. I remember when I was 11 years old, there was a girl that lived at the top of our block. We lived in row homes, and we played with her. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And this is another reason why, by the way, I did Precious. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and she opened the door. She was completely naked. It was the most bizarre, surreal. I didn't know what to make. She tried to cover. She was a little pudgy girl, and so she tried her best to cover her. She knew to cover her her breasts and her vagina. And she was drenched in blood. She was beaten with an extension cord. And she looked at me with absolute desperation, and she said, "My mother's going to kill me." Over my shoulder, there was my mother. And I had never seen fear in my mom's eyes. And I remember feeling nauseous, embarrassed for her, anger, sadness. I can't describe one word that describes how I felt. That feeling was how I felt when I read Precious. That feeling. And I wanted to never feel that way again. And I hope to heal myself and to heal others that had either been, you know, seen that or had been a part of that. But what was that having to do with anything that you had to say?
Well, you know, you had said that your father wouldn't, you don't think he arrested people for beating their children.
No, because I knew my mother. I think this is about the fear in my mother's eyes. Because once she took the hydrogen peroxide and cleaned her wounds, and we immediately put a sheet on her, I recall, because she was heavy and we didn't have any clothes to fit her. Once we had to do all that and nurse her and everything, we knew that we had to send her back to her mother. There wasn't a place, you know, unless you wanted your child just put away in a social service home, which was something that we didn't do. That would have been, and also it was a secret. You know, this stuff was secrets, you know. What went on behind closed doors was a secret. You know, I watched my uncle, he had just come back from Vietnam when I was 5, beat my little cousin. My cousin had to be 2. He was in a high chair, and he wouldn't eat his rice. And he beat him. 46 in Parrish, you know, in the kitchen. I'll never forget it. Blood was inside of the kid's rice on his high chair. I think he'd lost it over in Vietnam. And I remember his mother singing and humming a prayer in the corner. And my mother screaming and attacking and my aunt, screaming and attacking my other aunt, my uncle. But my father's saying this is private. People looked at things differently then. This is a private matter. Leave it in the house. Just keep stepping.
Now, you mentioned that your father wrote a poem about his dying, and it must have been some kind of premonition or something, because he was murdered. It's not like he had a terminal illness or something, but he was murdered in the course of a robbery, is what I read.
That's correct. He was a hero. He was a hero. It was, I don't know, it was December the 16th. I was 12. It was snowing. He left the house. He was Muhammad Ali's bodyguard. So that's how fierce he was. Six foot four. Yeah. At one point, he did some bodyguarding for him while in Philadelphia. And he came to the house once. I'll never forget my mother. My mother came down in rollers. My father went ballistic. He said, Muhammad Ali's here. Why are you in rollers? Where's your hair in rollers? My mother's been unimpressed with celebrity. But so he was really this macho, machismo, towering of a figure. He never used his gun. Didn't have to. He fought these kids on the street with his hands. And I think that I was completely the opposite. He bought me boxing gloves. I threw them on the floor. I'm going to play with my sister's, you know, doll babies and stuff. and I think that's what I love about my dad. You know, he knew that he couldn't beat out the spirit out of me. And I was like, you know, next assignment to embarrass you, Dad. But it was snowing, and it was he left his gun on the table. My mother said, "Why are you leaving the house with your gun? Without your gun? It's done. Don't worry about it." I'm across the street listening to Jackson 5 Christmas carols in the basement. I could hear my mother's piercing voice through the snow across the street. I knew that my dad had died. I knew. I'd never heard a more guttural screaming of my name from her. And it was a very, you know, hard time for all of us. And we sort of spiraled from there.
So what happened with your father? There was a robbery.
Yeah, the guys, they were kids, you know, kids, teenagers. And they with guns, and they came into the bar, and they were holding up the bar, and I think drugs were involved, I think. He said, "Kid, put the gun down." And they shot him in the leg. He kept walking. They said, "Kid, put the gun down." They shot him in the right shoulder. He kept walking. And then they came up to his head, and they shot him in his head. And I lived this through, you know, the whole thing with the courts, and it's like, it's really hard. I'm sure that's had a profound effect in my storytelling too. I think that it's, you don't know it, you know, you really don't know where you are until much later. I don't know.
In a lot of movies and novels, there's a kind of before and after. There's a turning point in somebody's life that changes their life. And, like, you actually had that with your father.
I did. And I did. I'm angry at him right now. I'm angry at him for not taking his gun. Because I know, look, men, I've seen it happen. I have an uncle now. I wasn't going to talk about it before, my uncle now, but he, you know, he's hard when I was a young guy. And he's so mellow now, man. He's so chill. He's so proud of me. And I so wish my dad were here, because he'd be so proud of me. You know, I know it. I just know that he would embrace my homosexuality with gusto. Times have changed so radically. And it just breaks my heart that he's not here with me, you know?
Yeah. Your two twins, from what I've read, the twins were your brother's children, and
they are my brother's biological
biologically
children.
Yeah.
Yes, and I've had them since they've been 3 days old, and they are my babies. And my brother had to be sent away, and his wife, you know, left them on my mom's doorstep, and I've had them since that day.
So he was in prison.
He went to prison for a moment. Yes. Mm-hmm.
What, after they were born?
Before they were born, he knew.
Oh,
that
I see.
He,
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he told me that he said he didn't think that his girlfriend wanted the kids. He called me. I was in L.A. He said, "I don't think my girlfriend's going to want these kids, and I got to do a little bit of time. And can you take them?" I said, "I have no intention on taking these kids. So never. You know, I'm doing my thing out in Palm Springs with the boys. You know what I mean? I'm having fun.
How old were you?
You know." I was, so if I'm 49 now, that was 13 years ago. So, but they changed my life. My mother, so the mother left them on my mother's doorstep, and my mother called me. I remember the call as if it were yesterday. She says, "I've raised 5 kids. I have raised, I don't know, 10, 12 grandkids. I have no intention on raising any more kids. And I'm calling social services." You can't call social services. You cannot. I knew she meant it, and I got on a plane, and there you go. The rest is history. My partner at the time, Billy Hopkins, who casts all of my movies, we raised them. We adopted them, and we raised them, and we've had them since.
In your new movie, Precious, Lenny Kravitz plays a nurse's aide. And
yes.
You had a nursing agency, I think, before you got into casting and producing and directing. Am I right about
I
that?
Did.
Yeah.
I did.
So the girls in Precious are surprised to see a male nurse. Was anyone surprised to see you, a male nurse? And was this the 80s?
I wasn't a nurse. I knew nothing of nursing at all. Let me just set the record straight.
So you were more management?
What happened was that I started as a receptionist at a nursing agency when I first came to Hollywood with intentions on being a writer. And what happened then was I started out as a receptionist, and then I started sales, and then I became a manager of the company. And I said, what the heck? You know, why am I doing this? You know, why can I open my own little agency? So I did, from my home in Hollywood. And I started with 5 nurses. It led to 500 nurses. Mm. I made an incredible amount of money. I knew at that time nothing of taxes, something called taxes, because I didn't know. And it was crazy.
Oops.
And also, yeah. And no one knew that I was 22 years old and taking care, and I knew nothing of nursing. And yet I had these nurses working for me. And a producer who had worked with Prince, he would come in every Saturday to slide his check under the door. And I happened to be there doing some accounting work on Saturday, and he freaked out that I was as young as I was taking care of his grandmother who was ill. And he looked at the agency and said, "Well, what?" And he was fascinated by it. He said, "Well, what do you want to do ultimately?" I said, "Write and direct." And he said, "Well, a good way of doing that would be to, you know, work as a PA, and, you know, I'm doing this, you know, this movie." And I said, "Sure." And you know what? Just like that, I sold the nursing agency. I put $2 million in my pocket. I sold it to a bigger company. And I would have made a lot more if I didn't know taxes on it, and I had to pay off the tax man. But, you know, I look back on that like it was nothing. I mean, that is a very incredible feat for a 22-year-old.
So you've had before you started producing and now directing,
yep.
You had experience... Okay, running a nursing agency, but you also had experience. You did casting. You did. Mm-hmm. You had a management company. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I did.
Managing actors.
What are some
of the things you learned about acting and casting from working in the field of casting and management? Because I'm sure you saw a lot of people who you felt weren't really getting roles that. In other words, I'm sure you thought a lot of people weren't getting the roles that they deserve that would really stretch them creatively?
Yes. What a woman that was very inspirational to me getting in the business, a woman named Paula Kelly, who was a dancer, who was in an actor, singer. She was in a movie called Sweet Charity. And I was casting some bad movie of the week, really bad. And And there was a prison movie or something, and there was a prison this woman that was the warden of a prison, and Paula Kelly, who should never have come in to audition for the role. She should have been offered the role. She came in, which was degrading enough, because I would have offered her the job, but the producers didn't know who she was. And so I'd pay $100 to see it again today, probably the most brilliant audition ever. And they ended up giving it to this blonde bimbette who played this prison warden, go figure. And I said, never again. That's it. It's a wrap. I'm going to find people like that work. Brilliant actors work. And then I didn't know that the struggle, I didn't know that it was going to be such a struggle to find African-Americans work in during that time, because there was none. I could not get Hollywood to accept that they couldn't be drug dealers or cops if we were lucky. You know, it was laughable. And I got tired of telling brilliant actors no.
Okay, so finally tell me, you've done casting, managing, producing, and directing. And your latest work is directing Precious. You've taken, yes, among other things, you've cast Monique, the actress and talk show host. You've cast Mariah Carey in this film. You cast a young obese woman in the starring role as Precious. You know, a lot of really unlikely choices that all really work. So to sum up, since you've done so many different things within the movie business, what do you think is the job of the director? What does the director, when it comes to acting, what does the director do to actually get a performance out of somebody that is, you know, the best performance that they can give?
I don't know what other directors do. I can only tell you what I do. I don't believe in a rehearsal process at all. It's more of a therapy session. They need to understand me, you know? So my rehearsal period is really me talking about my insecurities, my fears, my hopes, my dreams, sex, food, literature, gossip.
How is that helpful to your actors?
Music.
Caring about your insecurities.
They know me. They know everything about me. There's nothing I hide with my actor.
But how is that helpful for them giving their performance?
Because they know what I want to see. And then they sort of strip down. Like, I don't know how it helps. I just tell you how it's worked for me and how I've gotten performances out of actors. We don't talk about the work until we're on set, and we don't have rehearsals, and we just sort of walk through it. And I'm literally grunting and talking in tongue and using my hands and waving when I'm directing, because I don't yell action until we're not on the same paragraph or sentence or word, but syllable. We are one before I yell action. I'm moving my hands. I'm telling them, this is what I move your head this way, bat your eyes this way, lift your arms now. You know, and so it's I don't know how to explain it, but that's just my process.
So if the process is so kind of therapy oriented in a way, with you uncovering who you are and them uncovering that they are, was Precious a therapeutic experience for you in the end?
Yeah. I learned to love myself more. Because that's what she does. She's learned to love herself. And I learned never to look this girl in the face again and ignore her. Like, I will never not see her again.
Lee Daniels, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Lee Daniels directed the new film Precious. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the debut album by La Rue, a British pop music duo featuring 21-year-old singer Ellie Jackson and synthesizer player and producer Ben Langmaid. The pair's debut album, also called La Rue, was an immediate number one hit earlier this year in England and throughout Europe.
You put on your armor, you put up defenses, but what do you want? Because I'm here to protect you. So take it easy, I'll make it so easy. You can lay your head down, and we'll leave it till tomorrow. You seem to believe you belong to somebody else.
At a time when some of the most prominent American pop acts hold back the emotion in favor of rigorous control, I'm thinking of you, Lady Gaga, and you, Jay-Z, the full-throated ardor of LaRue's Ellie Jackson arrives as a nice corrective. When it comes to singing with heartbreak in her voice, Jackson's current competition in America would be a pop country singer like Taylor Swift. But there's nothing country about LaRue's clipped synthesizer riffs and tight but expansive choruses. Ellie Jackson sings with agonized urgency, a demonstrative defensiveness, on a disco love song such as LaRue's biggest hit so far, Bulletproof. This time, baby, I'll be bulletproof, sings Ellie Jackson as her partner, Ben Langmaid, stabs out sharp notes on a synthesizer. They rev up the music into a hurricane swirl of stubbornness and vulnerability. She may say she's bulletproof, but Jackson is singing with a wounded cry of a woman who's been wronged and hurt too many times before. There's nothing new about this, of course, but what draws you in is the tension between the mechanical beats and the passionate singing.
You say it's coming, but I can't see it at all. You know me well, but I don't know you at all. No, I don't know you at all. It's always just on the horizon, so my hopes rise and fall. You know me well, but I don't know you at all. No, I don't know you at all. Early nights, day call. It was a day for. We wanted to play, but we had nothing left to play for. Colorless color. Once in fashion, soon to be seen.
That song, Colorless Color, is very much an example of the 1980s styles LaRue draws from. Overseas acts such as The Human League, Yazoo, and Depeche Mode ring in your ears as you listen to various songs on the album. Ellie Jackson bends and snaps her vocals in a manner that would bring a blush to the cheek of Boy George. And on this song, Cover My Eyes, LaRue enlists the London Community Gospel Choir to back Ellie Jackson in a chorus that, rather remarkably, never becomes overblown. That's because of a vocal from Jackson that's a perfect pop paradox. Quavery, delicate, yet surgingly strong. On stage, LaRue can seem a one-person show. Ben Langmaid doesn't tour with Jackson or her backing band. He doesn't even allow himself to be photographed if possible. And Ellie Jackson makes up for that absence with a striking theatricality, some of it on the top of her head. The cherry red hair that gives the act its name is sculpted into something that looks like a wave in an ocean storm, or a canoe that's being buffeted by that wave. Combine this with her slight frame and scrunched up face when she sings, and you've got a performer who's holding nothing back in an arch, witty, calculated way.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the debut album from LaRue. 40-year-old, 6-foot-5-inch, Utah-born and raised Jared Hess had a cult smash hit with the 2004 comedy Napoleon Dynamite, in which a tall, gawky Utah nerd finds love and does a funky dance. Hess's new comedy, which he co-wrote with his wife Jerusha, is called Gentlemen Broncos. The movie opened in limited release last Friday to wildly mixed reviews, and our film critic David Edelstein wants to make the case for it.
I don't think there's ever been a comedy as freakishly, surreally psychosexual as Jared Hess's Gentlemen Broncos. It's the story of a teenager who writes unpublished, Dune-like sci-fi novels called Yeast Wars, in which the hero has his gonads stolen and faces off in a rocky desert against laser-blasting memories. The kid, Benjamin, played by Michael Angarano, is clearly sublimating like mad to relieve his sexual discomfort. But often Hess cuts to his fantasies, scenes from his novels enacted on screen. And they're so visionary and intense that they hurtle past Freud. They have a Jung-like, mythical dimension. His protagonist, Bronco, played by Sam Rockwell, is part cowboy, part Flash Gordon. His battles are gloriously tacky and psychedelic. He rides robotic deer and dodges cyclops and pursues a jelly jar with his pilfered private parts. These fantasies lift the movie into a realm both lofty and madcap. The down-to-earth realm is loco in a different way. Hess co-wrote and directed Napoleon Dynamite and the Mexican wrestler comedy with Jack Black, Nacho Libre, and at times he uses deadpan like a cudgel. Geeky characters stare off screen with their mouths hanging open. They're uncomfortable in their own flesh. Benjamin is homeschooled and awkward around people. He moves through the world on the verge of tears, looking as if he wants to will his own body out of existence. I've never seen a teen hero so stricken. His mom is the wonderful actress Jennifer Coolidge, who's comically full-figured, yet playing a character trying to become a designer with a line of ultra-modest nightgowns, while Benjamin's own work explodes with sex and violence. When Benjamin leaves his dome house to travel to a convention of young, would-be fantasy writers, he gets to meet his author hero, Dr. Ronald Chevalier, played by Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords. Even if you love Jemaine on TV, you'll be unprepared for his brilliance here. He wears a dark, heavy beard and speaks in the toasty tones of James Mason's Captain Nemo. He gives a lecture in how to name one's characters, then calls on Benjamin, who's bewildered by his role model's fatuous pomposity.
Need thou not be afraid, for we can turn a humdrum, forgettable name like Nebuchadnezzar into something magical like this. Nebuchadnezzar. And it's that easy. We can add Onius. Anus or anus to just about anything, and it becomes magical. You, give me the name of one of your central protags.
Bronco.
What is he? A centaur?
No.
Does he shapeshift into equine form ever?
No, he's just a man.
Well, then, I would lose the C immediately, and I'd replace it with an L, Bronlonius.
Gentleman Broncos finally turns on the theft of Benjamin's work. Chevalier steals his manuscript, inserting, of course, his own ridiculous character names and turning Bronco into a transvestite. We see scenes from his Yeast Wars acted on screen, and they're even more bizarre than Benjamin's. Then a girl named Tabitha, played by a hilariously deadpan Halle Pfeiffer, pays Benjamin to use Yeast Wars as the basis for a threadbare, softcore bodice ripper movie directed by her friend Lonnie, played by Hector Jimenez, whose mouth is a rictus of lust. Nutty and campy as all this is, there's a serious theme. Vastly disparate sexual issues are being worked out through these outlandish fantasies. Each vision is different, and in the end, Benjamin has to stand up like any artist and fight for his own vision. Some of Hess's gross-out gags are heavy-handed. The grotesquerie is laid on too thick. His work is best when he doesn't force it, when he lets you observe, casually, his menagerie of weirdos. But Gentlemen Broncos is a leap over his previous work. Now, Hess doesn't just gaze on paralyzed nerds from the outside. He takes you into their heads and gives form to their alienation from the physical world. Hess is a Mormon from a famously modest culture, yet he's clearly inspired by David Lynch. Even his flattest images teem with creepy undercurrents. I was always on the verge of either laughing or squirming, sometimes both at once. Let's call that verge Hess Country, where even your tackiest dreams can take flight.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.